morning, everybody. Good morning. 2 weeks ago, I gave a talk about the life and teachings of Joko Beck, who was a very well-known and innovative American Zen teacher who died in this last June. And today, I want to talk about some parallels between the way that she worked with emotions and one of the early Buddhist texts. One of the things that she was particularly known for was integrating Western psychology into Buddhist practice. And she would have her students, when they were meditating, she would have them note their emotions as they arose, especially their difficult emotions, the afflictive emotions, and their reactivity to those emotions as they arose during Zazen. And then she would have them actively work with those emotions as a key part of their meditation practice. So that they weren't trying to meditate in spite of these emotions that were coming up, but they were working directly with them. And the idea was to free themselves from being caught by those emotions and eventually to be able to see more clearly and live a more compassionate life. So today I would like to read some excerpts from an 8th century Indian text that talks about working with our minds and our emotions. The text is the Bodhicaryavatara by Shantideva. It's probably better known as the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. It's a pretty famous text. And I'm going to be using the translation that Pema Chodron used in her commentary that she wrote on it a couple of years ago. Shantideva was a young man who was a monk in a large monastic university in 8th century India. It's described as a university, but it's also described as a monastery. So it's some kind of a hybrid. And he was given the opportunity, or you might say the challenge, to give a talk to the entire assembly of monks. So we're talking about hundreds or thousands of monks. And he surprised all of them by reciting a long series of verses, 10 chapters of verses that he had written on his own based on the Buddha's teaching, that he had written for himself to encourage his own practice, his own development as an aspiring bodhisattva, someone who saves all beings, frees all beings. So the text it's very human and it's very personal. And he talks about his own doubts and hesitations. And he's very honest about his problems and his failings, where he feels like he's fallen short. And he also talks about all the different things that come up in his mind. So by the time you get done feeling, by the time I get done reading it, I feel like I know this guy. I know this guy. And today I want to talk about just a very small slice of it. There are two chapters that come out of a couple of the two chapters, chapters 4 and 5, using our intelligence and taming the mind. In chapters 1 through 3, he sort of introduces what he's going to talk about, and he talks about arousing bodhicitta, or arousing the heart mind, arousing the mind of liberation, of awakening. And then he talks about developing and maintaining that mind. And that's the groundwork for everything else in the text. Then in chapter 4, using our intelligence, he starts talking about working with the emotions. So, you know, when we just sit like we just did for 40 minutes, our thoughts come and go, you know. They arise and they leave again, no problem. We just come back to the present moment over and over again. But once in a while, when we sit, really strong emotions can arise, and sometimes they're negative ones. And Shantideva uses the examples from his own life, including quite often he talks about, particularly about anger and lust, which makes perfect sense when you think about it for a young man who's living in a monastery with, I would imagine that a lot of anger and lust would be on your mind. So he starts off with that in the first verse I want to read. This is chapter 4, verse 28. He says, "Anger, lust, these enemies of mine, are limbless and devoid of faculties. They have no bravery, no cleverness. How then have they reduced me to such slavery?" Slavery. So he starts off by calling them enemies. Enemies. And he really struggles with them. He really struggles with these enemies of his. And yet, he recognizes that they're limbless. They have no arms, no legs. They have no faculties. There's no solidity to them. You know, there's no essential nature of their own. In fact, they don't exist anywhere except in his own mind. They're just illusions. And that's a very Zen point of view, I think. And yet, even though he sees that, he's enslaved by them. Enslaved by it. Now, that's pretty pretty dire language, saying you're enslaved by them. But when these afflictive emotions rise in our lives, we can get so hooked on them, we can get so intoxicated by them that it might feel like enslavement, you know. And after the storm passes, we can't believe how they've taken over our minds. When it's over, we say, well, how did that happen? Where did that come from? What was that all about? How did I get so caught up in that? But the good news is that he sees it. He sees it in verse 428. And because of his strong desire to awaken the heart of liberation, this is his practice, and it's a very strong desire on his part, he's beginning to wake up to his life and see these kinds of things happening. And step one, of course, in making any kind of change, working with any kind of emotional turmoil, is to see it and to see what it does to us. So in verse 432, he says, "No other enemy indeed has lived so long as my defiled emotions." And then he describes them as my endless and beginningless companions. Just a second, excuse me. So he's distraught by how they keep coming back and back and back. Over and over and over again. Is this ever going to end? You know, these emotions that we carry around with us become what we would call habitual patterns that seem like they have no beginning, and they certainly seem like there is no way to end them. I don't know about you, I get that way sometimes, feeling there's just no way. But he does find some hope in 447. He says, "Where is their abode from which they wreak their havoc on the world? They are simple mirages, and so take heart." And so take heart. He asks himself, why suffer needlessly the pains of life? So he's asking, where is their abode? You know, where do they live? Where do they live? You know, it feels like there's something solid there. you know, the next time you're caught by one of these emotions, just stop and see if it doesn't feel like there's something solid there. I'll bet it does. I'll bet it does. A couple of years ago, we were in a study group, and we were talking about just this, about how, you know, our emotions and our thought patterns are fleeting, and they have no solidity to them. And I walked out thinking, yeah, oh yeah. And about 2 hours later, I got caught up in this mess of anger and embarrassment and defensiveness. And I remember thinking, this feels awfully solid to me. and then that got me madder that it wasn't true. That it wasn't true. So the next time you get caught up in some afflictive emotion, just stop and see, does it feel solid to you? And if it does, you know, wait about half an hour. And then a little bit later, in retrospect, we could see that it wasn't so solid. But when we're in the middle of it, it looks pretty like a big, you know, hairball stuck in here somewhere. But they're not solid. He calls them simple mirages. And he tells himself that there's nothing to be afraid of, to banish all your fear and strive to know their nature. So when he talks about striving to know their nature, he's not talking about getting to know their storyline. He's not talking about going over and rehashing the incidents that kick-started this, whatever it was. Joko said that she wrote in one of her books about how thoughts may come and go, and you're sitting and sitting, thoughts come, thoughts go, and then when an emotion settles in, to let go of the thoughts that are associated with it, to drop that thought, and just get to know the emotion. To really feel the sting and the self-righteousness or whatever it is that comes with that emotion. To get to know its nature, we need to get out of the head with it, get out of that thinking mode, and see how it feels in the body. For example, if you're talking about sorrow, or if sorrow comes up, you know, it can feel like, maybe it feels to you like just this weight that presses down right here. And it's just this really solid weight pressing down. But we also understand that we're not sitting with something that's called sorrow. What we're sitting with is all the beings in the world who are feeling sorrow at that time. All the beings in the world who have ever felt sorrow. And if that sounds kind of grandiose, that might sound a little grandiose, just think about the last time you were at a funeral. And you can feel in the room all of the shared sorrow of all the beings in the room. You know what that feels like? Remember that? And you also feel the flip side, the other side. You also feel the consolation that comes from being in this shared sorrow with all the other beings in the room. And it's the same thing with Zazen. If you are sitting on your cushion and you feel some deep wave of sorrow, you can just remind yourself that you are sitting with all the beings in the world who ever have had sorrow. And then you can breathe some consolation in there. Same thing with anger, same thing with defensiveness, same thing with grief. Same thing with annoyance. Annoyance is a great one. We, you know, we have people walking by a lot outside. Yesterday we had all the windows open during Zazen. And we had an unusual number of chatty people using their outside voices right outside our window. And, you know, it's very easy to just get annoyed by that. I am trying to do my Zazen here, you know. but you can also go to I'm sitting here right in the middle of it with everybody. Noisy voices and all. Noisy voices and all. So, you know, that sounds like kind of a long process to go through, but it's really very quick, you know. The emotion arises. Here it is. We see it. We feel it. We breathe in that consolation for ourselves and the countless beings who have felt this. And then it dissipates. We let it dissipate. So it's not like you have to get out your book and say, okay, what am I doing now? Let's see. Oh, yeah, dissipate. It becomes a very natural habitual reaction that's on the good side. So, but what it does take is some attentiveness and mindfulness. And Shanti Deva said that he developed those qualities by taming the mind. You know, sometimes we have very quiet, peaceful minds, especially when we're sitting, we'll have these very quiet, peaceful minds. But sometimes they aren't quiet at all. And in the chapter on taming the mind, at one point, he compares the mind to a wild elephant stampeding. You know, and think about it, you know, this big, scary, loud animal kicking up dust, and you don't know what's going to happen next. You know, I think it's a good metaphor for those heavy emotions that come up in our minds. And how in the world are we going to remain calm and attentive and mindful when we're in the middle of an elephant stampede? It's not so easy. We use the term monkey mind, and I think it's a really good one for the way that our minds just kind of scurry around. Whenever I see the squirrels outside and I see them darting around, that is just like my mind. Look at that. But it's adorable, you know? Maybe I should say, and it's adorable too. But what goes on in our minds sometimes can feel not so much like an adorable squirrel, but a whole lot more like there's a big giant elephant in the room, and it's got its trunk up, you know, and it's trumpeting, and it feels it's got much more of that heavy, scary, loud, what's going to happen now kind of feeling to it. There's a story about elephants, about how in India they would, when they would have to walk the elephants through the village, the elephants would be walking down these streets and they'd be looking all over the place, you know, and their trunks would be going like this and their ears would be going like this and they'd be stomping and all, and they would cause this huge amount of chaos. And so according to the story, what the elephant tamers, what the people driving the elephants would do is get a big stick and put the stick in the elephant's mouth. And supposedly that would divert the elephant's attention from everything around it, and it would just walk very calmly paying attention to this stick. And so they didn't have to worry so much about what the elephant was going to do. And our equivalent to putting that stick in the elephant's mouth is counting our breaths, or coming back to the present moment, or maybe using a mantra. You know, it's something to help us calm down that elephant. When we do that, we're attending to the mind. We're taking care of the mind. And we're actually taming the mind in the same way that they did with the elephants. So Shanti Deva uses the metaphor of tethering the elephant. In chapter 5, verse 3, he talks about tethering the elephant. He says, if with mindfulness's rope the elephant of the mind is tethered all around, our fears will come to nothing, every virtue drop into our hands. our fears will come to nothing. They just dissolve. You know, they just dissolve. When we calm the mind, every virtue will drop into our hands. Every virtue. And that means that our true nature can emerge. You know, sort of that innate goodness. We can act out of kindness and skillfulness instead of emotional turmoil or emotional reactivity. You know, has that ever happened to you out of the blue? You'll be out somewhere and somebody will say something or something will happen that on any other day would have just set you off, just like that. But for some reason, on this day, it didn't. And then afterwards, I'm always so amazed by that. What just happened there? How did that happen? Ordinarily, man, I would have been after that one. Boy. And I think it's that at that point you had a calm mind. And so you were able to prevent that emotional reactivity from coming up. You know, it feels like the ability to do that comes from nowhere, but I don't think it comes from nowhere. It's that virtue that just dropped into our hands because we've been practicing this. So we tether the elephant with our daily persistent practice. You know, we're in this for the long haul. Our practice is meditation. You know, this is the same Dharma talk that we give every week. Our practice is meditation. I recommend that we do it. There's only one Dharma talk. You know that, right? And when we practice this mindfulness and this attention and this taking care on the cushion, then we're going to be able to do it when we're off the cushion as well. And in my mind, if you can, you know, I don't care what a wonderful meditator you are when you're on the cushion. I don't care what kind of wonderful experiences you have. That's very nice. What about when you get off the cushion? That's when I care a whole lot more. That was another thing Jogo talked to her students a lot about, too. What happens when you're off the cushion? She also talked about watching her own mind as she went through her everyday life. That, you know, she would find herself in the middle of a conversation with somebody, and something would just come up in her mind, or maybe pop out of her mouth, and she would just stop and notice it. Oh, what was that? Oh, look at that. And, you know, she wouldn't interrupt the conversation or anything. The other person didn't even know she was doing that. But she would just stop and notice it. Stop and notice it. With the idea that she's getting to know her emotional reactivity and she's working on it. So, here's the last one. Chapter 5, verse 47. When you feel the wish to walk about or even to express yourself in speech, first examine what is in your mind, for they will act correctly who have stable minds. And we know what that's like too. We know what that's like to have a stable mind. Our ability to act out of a stable mind, that spacious mind, that's always here and it's always available. It may not look like it's always available, may not seem like it, but it is. Whether there's some emotional elephant stomping around in the middle of the room or in the middle of your mind or not. So that's what an 8th century monk had to say about working with his emotions, and I think it tracks pretty well with the way some schools of thought work with the emotions in the West these days. So after I gave the talk 2 weeks ago, that one little piece of it about working with the emotions kind of just stuck with me and stuck with me and stuck with me until I remembered, well, you're thinking about Shantideva, so I thought I'd bring it in and try to overlay those two and see what happened. But now I'd be interested in hearing what someone else has to say. If you have any questions, or if you have anything you want to talk about, if you have any other animals in your heads. Let's talk animals. Today is Arnie's birthday. Happy birthday, Arnie. 82, right?
Right. So, something that has struck me about the kind of relates to what you were talking about is the delightful insidiousness of practice. I mean, for example, there's a story Sharon Salzberg tells. You know, she's really into the whole metta phrase practice thing. She's in that school, and she spent a whole month doing metta practice on the cushion, doing the phrases of developing metta for herself. Mm-hmm. And she was pretty sure it didn't work, and then she tripped or dropped something or banged into something, and she said, oh, to herself, oh, you're so clumsy, but I love you anyway. And she said, hey, this is working. And you know, I hear that from people around here, that they just, that coming here and setting up a practice for themselves, how it's changed them. And not because they set out to make a change, but because there's this insidiousness to having a practice that you don't notice until it's already, you know, fully fledged.
Yeah, it's true. Insidious is a good word. You know, especially because, you know, in Zen we say we do this without any idea of a goal. You know, Zen is not a self-improvement program. And despite everything I've said this morning, it's not a self-improvement program. And yet, things change in every moment. And we have a hand in that. Or we can have a hand in that.
So your remarks about sharing sorrow, the feelings of sorrow with other beings, reminds me of something that happened, which I've actually shared here before, but I see a lot of new faces, so I'll talk about it again. This was the Limon dance troupe came through and performed at the Walker way back, I don't remember, last winter. And it was the kind of performance that drove half the audience out of the theater in the course of it, but the half that stayed, wow. And I was in that second half, fortunately for me. But one portion of it began with an empty stage, and a woman off stage began sobbing deeply, just expressing such profound sorrow and grief that it was very uncomfortable. I mean, especially since there was nobody there. You just heard the sounds of this weeping. And then eventually she came on stage. And while this was happening, first of all, I got very uncomfortable. And then I realized, well, I felt exactly that emotion. Maybe not as purely as she was expressing it, but that same kind of grief, loss, infinite, it seemed. And it went on. The performance continued. The woman continued to sob, and I realized, and in fact, I've caused others to feel that way. Exactly that way. And it continued still. And then I realized, and there are millions of people right now in this world who are feeling precisely this sense of profound loss. Mm-hmm. That performance was a great gift. I don't know. I think my practice probably helped me appreciate it. I don't know how many of the people who walked out of the theater were not involved in meditative practice. Maybe they were, and it just didn't open a door for them. Yeah. But thank you for that reminding.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. You know, we really, when we're bound up in these emotions, especially the hard ones, the ones that we'd rather push away, we really feel like we're the only one. And I think it's a key part of our practice to, when we're feeling that, to broaden that out to all beings, because, well, for one thing, that's how you really experience the interconnectedness, the lack of borders in between all of us. Yeah.
Rosemary, you're talking about tethering the elephant reminded me of a very short poem, which I was always taught was about the creative process, but I really think it's about meditation. And it goes, hands, do what you're bid. Bring the balloon of the mind that bellies and drags in the wind into its narrow shed.
Say that again.
Hands, do what you're bid. Bring the balloon of the mind that bellies and drags in the wind into its narrow shed.
Ooh.
And if you think of those dirigibles in their shed, that's quite a feat to get into.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. Wonderful.
I have a hard time expressing emotion verbally and naming what that emotion is. I play music from the heart. I play violin, and it comes from the dead. And I express my emotion with music. And so I'm not able to articulate it, but it's all the things you're saying. And I connect with people in the audience as I perform. And I take them on a journey on how I see and experience the piece that I'm performing. And I can interpret it in different ways depending on how I'm feeling. And I can't necessarily articulate how I'm feeling until it starts to come off to me. And it's a wonderful way to kind of connect with people in a way that they don't necessarily even understand and begin to kind of expect. And by the end of the performance, either through visual or a connection, you know, through eye contact.
Thank you. I've been on the other side of that, the receiving side of that, and I felt that on the receiving side, and it's quite wonderful. And you're right, it's something that you can't articulate. You try, but you just can't. Mm-hmm.